Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to Big Blend Radio's fourth Friday Nature Connection show. Normally Nancy's here with me and Margo Carrera, who's a nature photographer. Together we love to talk about wildlife conservation, the environment, and you can also keep up with everything we do with parks and public lands if you go to nationalparktraveling.com. But today we are going to talk about public lands, and then we're going to talk about wolves. We have Eli Frankovich joining us. He's a journalist who covers the environment and conservation and outdoor recreation out in the beautiful state of Washington for the Spokesman's Review. It is the state's second largest newspaper, but not only does he do newspaper work, he wrote a book. It's called The Return of Wolves, An Iconic Predator's Struggle to Survive in the American West. It's out now through Timber West and, of course, Timber Press. You can get it anywhere you buy books. So welcome back to, well, I was gonna say welcome back, but welcome. Yeah. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here, and especially talking to your audience and the folks that care. So
about wolves. Yeah, it's a complex thing. I know before we started recording, so I was like, welcome back. started recording. I was like, this is very similar to, you know, the wild horse issue of the West and also in the East, actually, in some areas. And everybody's got a different angle. Yeah.
And my book is, it is very, you know, it focuses quite a lot on Washington State and Idaho, but I think it has broader sort of relevance for any sort of conservation and question of coexistence, because that's just like us, that's just becoming increasingly pressing, right? As more people and more wild animals are trying to figure out how to live together. So,
yeah, you know, it's kind of like, you know, these wildlife corridors that we're creating, like even over highways and things like that, like what California has done. And it is coexistence, but there's fear, there's money involved too, because of the ranching. If a wolf takes out, you know, cattle, then people get a little pissy about it.
Yeah, it has an impact. Yeah, certainly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what got you started in actually going out and covering wolves as a whole? I know, obviously, you're covering conservation and the environment, but wolves.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'll give a little background on wolf recovery in the Western U.S. and also my life. So I grew up in Idaho, Southern and also Northern Idaho. And then I've been in Eastern Washington for a decade now. It's a beautiful place. I mean, I love the Western U.S. in general, particularly where I live. It's just gorgeous, and a lot of relatively wild space and animals. And one of those animals is gray wolves, of course, now. And and for those that don't know, wolves used to be one of the most widely distributed land mammals on planet Earth. They live in this amazing array of habitats. They can live in the desert, and then they can also live in like -40 degree tundra and the Arctic, right? So they're just incredibly versatile that way. But starting sort of with European colonization of the Americas, there was a really concerted and focused effort to trap and kill off the wolves. Mm-hmm. And that was partly, you know, a financial and like lifestyle choice, right? Because they're of grazing cattle and sheep and what else. But then there's also sort of almost like a religious and philosophical desire to tame the wilderness, and wolves have always sort of represented the wild. I have a couple different ideas on that. Maybe we chat about it later. But so in all to say that by the 1920s and 30s, wolves were pretty much gone from the lower 48. There's a few pockets here and there and a few sightings here and there, but mostly gone. And that began to change in the 1990s. And that's when the federal government reintroduced wolves to Yellowstone National Park, and then also some places in Idaho. And those populations grew, they did well, and they began to expand out and spread out. And so they reached Washington State, which is, you know, west of Yellowstone and Idaho, in 2008. Well, there was wolves there, sightings here and there, but the first sort of reliable reproducing pack was in 2008. And since then, the population of wolves in Washington has grown every year, usually like 12% or more even. So they're doing pretty well, but they've caused all sorts of social and political and cultural division, because wolves in Washington and most Western states are living obviously in rural areas. And so the people that live there, ranchers and farmers and loggers and what else, they are have taken on the brunt of the coexistence work, right? And then these are stereotypes, of course, but the people that often are most excited about wolves returning to a place live in cities and actually don't have any sort of skin in the game, so to speak. And so that's caused, I think, some tension and division. And this book is really looking at that. It talks about the ecology and biology, but it is really focused on these political and social divides that wolves, through no fault of their own, really sort of highlight.
Yeah, and then they also have the whole going into like mythology and everything. It's like, oh, Little Red Riding Hood. So they have this negative thing that still kind of, it starts when you're a kid. They've been put in as the, you know, the big, bad, ugly wolf in fairy tales and grows from there. Yet here they are, this incredibly important apex species. And, you know, it's interesting. Yeah.
And conversely, I think there's a lot of love and aggrandizement of wolves, almost in the opposite direction, right? And I think that speaks to, and I can only speak for myself, I guess, but I've often felt like I'm divorced and sort of disconnected from the natural world, and something about a wolf, it gives you hope, like, oh yeah, it's still there and it's still accessible. I think there's very few people feel indifferent about wolves. It's very strong feelings one way or the other. So
I think they're beautiful. they're amazing. You know, it's interesting because you say, because even when we lived in Arizona, we had two little things happen with wolves, but they used to be prolific out there too. Jaguars and ocelot. So it's kind of like that same situation, but with you, I know you started covering it in the newspaper and then you're like, oh, I got to go out deeper because it's just not, there's something not quite, there's more. And then did you ever think, okay, now it's going to become a book, or did you, when you started to go deeper, think, uh-oh, now I've opened like the biggest rabbit hole.
I mean, how it happened basically was, I was covering it for the paper, sort of daily stories. And I was getting sort of flack from both sides, honestly, people saying that I hated wolves and people saying that I was a wolf lover. And so, which usually means you're probably doing a pretty good job as a journalist, but I kind of felt like I was missing something, that there was some deeper story there that I wanted to get at. And so I went out on basically a tour of wolf country with a rancher and a biologist and a politician. And on that tour, which is interesting, I learned a lot from all three of them, but on that tour, I met this guy, just kind of happenstance, named Daniel Curry. And he's a range rider. And so what that means is he spends days and nights and early mornings basically trying, and this is on public land for the most part, trying to find, like, keep wolves from attacking cattle that are grazing. And he's dedicated, he has dedicated the majority of his life to this work. And he was a fascinating character for me and really opened up this story for me and made it really more accessible, because he loves wolves. He's got this deep connection, and he talks about animals in a very familial, sort of like almost spiritual way. And he's amazing with animals. Like, the way he works with them is just incredible. I've never seen anything like that. But he also has sort of done the work in many cases to show ranchers that he also cares about them and their cattle and their perspective. And so he's trying to strike this balance and show a way for coexistence to work. And just his own personal story, which is in the book, and kind of that's the narrative thread that holds it all together, I just found really compelling. But more to the point, he was like a case study in like making coexistence work and not just ignoring one or the other side and trying to find a balance.
Yeah, that's what I got, like, from everything, is it's balance. And that's something we as society have to get, you know. It's like after COVID, everybody just went crazy in our public lands, and without thinking, oh, we need balance as human beings, and this is why we walk dogs. Now we need to walk ourselves, you know. Right. And then it's like, oh, let's go and trample the land too. So there's a balance in how to do that and the coexistence. There's a lot of fear about coexistence. Yeah. Do you pick that up with your reporting and especially when it comes to wolves? I mean, there's the love of it, but you're saying like the city folks maybe not out there riding the range, but there's that fear. There's a little bit of, you know, we'll go, yeah, we want to save the wolves. But then if you spend the night out there and hear it, like if you hear them, that's a whole other planet.
It's beautiful, but it's eerie, isn't it?
Well, you know, I grew up in Africa, so down in the bush in Kenya and South Africa, and my best nights were listening to hyenas and jackals. And if you are out there and the lion roars, it is not. It's magical, but it is like, oh yeah, man, it's humbling is the word.
Yeah, that's the best mystical way to say it. I always felt going into this project, I was glad I felt this way. I felt a bit agnostic about wolves. Like I didn't understand why people hated them, but I also didn't really understand why, you know, some people love them so much. And I think I got a little insight into both viewpoints when I actually saw a wild wolf for the first time. And this was during the project, the reporting this book. I was driving on a Forest Service road and saw this wolf off the side of the road. So I jumped out of my car. It was early in the morning in this mountain range near here, and hiked over to the edge of the road and looked down. And about 100 yards downhill was this wolf, and it was looking back at me. And we made eye contact. It felt like a minute or two. Probably it was much shorter. That's something I noticed. Talking to people that had encounters with wolves is they lost all perspective on time and size and distance. Something very different happens. And I experienced that, but we made eye contact and it was really intense. And I really realized, and I knew this intellectually before, but I felt that this was an animal that had its own like desires and will and destiny that was independent of human interest or my interest. And it really didn't care what I was doing, in a way that I think challenges humanity's like belief in its total control over the world. And obviously we have a ton of control over the natural environment, but I think wolves somehow represent that like humbling, they can be like a humbling element. And I think there's people react in different ways. Some people get angry and some people sort of idolize it because it reminds them of something that maybe they feel like they lost. So that's my theory. And that was my experience. And it really gave me some insight into like some of these strong feelings and passions that come up.
And then we find out chihuahuas are related, right? Yeah. So it's like a whole other part of it. It's like dogs and wolves. So we try to domesticate them. So it's kind of like, it's a control thing us humans have. It's a weird thing.
And you know
what's
amazing is some of the newest research last couple of years at least is indicates that probably wolves domesticated themselves. So they chose us. So
there it is. Hey, get my food. Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. It's an easier life. It's hard to be a wolf.
I want to talk about this balance part because it is interesting about the perspectives, because I know when you start researching things like this, it's hard not to go in one way. And to even when you report something like this is to have your own internal balance. And when we started documenting parks and public lands, we started with National Park Service. Then we do every park now because every space matters for everything, whether it's history or a pocket park or, you know, we don't want dead zones really. Right. And so we started working with the Forest Service, who got mad at us for just doing park service stuff. And they said, well, we're underfunded too. Like, and we got all these, you know, we got the earfuls. And I remember the first Forest Service person we interviewed was on a live broadcast at an adventure show. And Park Service was there, Forest Service. And they said, well, here, when you come here, I still couldn't believe it. I was like, I'm going to hang up everything. And then I realized you got to let it be. In the Forest Service, you can go cut your Christmas tree, you can go rock hounding, you can do all this stuff. And I'm like, well, that's not good. You know what I mean? That was my immediate reaction. And then they were like, well, we're the balance. And so I do now get that in a way, but also with the Bureau of Land Management and how the management practices are, we've worked with every type at this point.
Right. Trying to
covering
find
places.
That.
Yeah. Wildlife refuges and I mean, and we've gone to wildlife refuges that are pumping oil and you're trying to get a photo of here's these beautiful pelicans, but there's an oil derrick behind them. Mm-hmm. And so here's this balance. And so I kind of feel like, all right, we actually have to have that, because we always, you know, to us, like, you know, public land, it needs to be the wilderness.
Yeah.
So we need the space for humans to kind of balance, but also the animals, like the cattle ranching was always a big deal on public land. And so even then I'm going like, huh, there's all of these little elements. It's complicated.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think that balance is huge. And that's something that I know biologists in Washington and probably elsewhere are trying to figure out how to integrate that sort of really local level of knowledge into big picture management. And it's the same thing. Their indigenous knowledge is actually quite similar in mm-hmm. some ways, because there's like tribes that have, and people that have been in one area, like, you know, for thousands of years with this, with some continuity. And they know that place in a really intimate way. And then how do you interface that with like, you know, the scientific method and modern ecological management and all of that. And I think that's something biologists here are really trying to work with, because the people in Washington state who are having to learn to coexist with wild carnivores, they have a deep connection to the place they live in most cases, of course, there's mm-hmm. exceptions, but I would say the average cattle rancher really care, at least in Washington and in smaller cattle ranchers, really, they do really care about the environment they're working in. They just have a different mm-hmm. view of what that means. Like, obviously they're ranching, so it looks a little different, but and so you can't just discount that, even if maybe it needs to be tempered sometimes with other perspectives.
Yeah, I've learned that it's things have to be complex to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did an interview recently with the director of the Texas Aquarium Association, and we were talking about, because he's right, they've opened a wildlife rescue center. We're seeing more of that happen with zoos and aquariums, start to go more into rescue and sanctuary kind of thing. It's different everywhere. So everything I'm saying, don't yell at me, people, of any of it. It it is what it is. But we were talking about solar and oil, right? And because he's at the Bay of Corpus Christi, but the aquarium, because of the oil being there, if the aquarium wasn't there, that bay is probably going to be toxic. Because they're there, they're the ones cleaning the water and watching the water samples to make sure, because they're the ones doing the rescues and taking, you know. So there's this interesting balance. And we were starting to talk about energy, and because public land is also becoming the hub of energy.
Yeah,
So that threatens all wildlife, including wolves. And so we talk about that, and he's like, you know, you can't just take one out. You can't just put solar everywhere. You can't just put this, you know. So I think it is about a little bit of everything, not all concentrated in one. And the ranchers I know really know the land better than nature enthusiasts who go hiking once a week.
Definitely. No, I think that's exactly the point. And that's in my book, right? Like, there's not one single answer to any of this. And I think anyone that says there is probably trying to sell you something. It's complex. And even like, you know, we were talking a bit about having humility as humans. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like, we think we know a lot, and we do know a lot about how the world works, but we're learning, like, wild animals are surprising us every day in their behavior, of things that we're learning. And that's happening with wolves. So a lot of what we know about wolves comes from places like Yellowstone or Alaska, mm-hmm. where there's just not a lot of people. And the return of wolves to that ecology had a big obvious impact. It's different in places like Washington or Colorado or Oregon, where there's a lot of people, and they're coming to a human landscape, a human adapted landscape. So we're learning a ton about what that looks like. What does it look like to have wolves living next to humans? And that's what Washington's a fascinating state for a lot of reasons. But one of the things is that it's the second smallest Western state geographically, but it has like 7 or 8 million people living here. And we also have almost a full suite of native carnivores. So we have black bears and wolves and cougars and occasional grizzly bears living sometimes within like an hour of Seattle, you know? Like,
that's amazing.
It's a wild situation that humans haven't been in really much in our history.
Awesome. Like, you know, that they're even alive, you know,
that
to me is an awesome thing. But you're right. How do we balance this where people understand and not just go, that don't let fear overcome, you know what I mean? And have a I think it really goes down to awareness. And actually, the more you get to watch animals and the more you go out into nature and observe, you start to understand. But there are people doing some things, trying. There was a, I'm going to think it was like 15 years ago, kind of when we started the podcast, 15, 16 years ago, we interviewed a ranch, Lava Lake Lamb, I think, this is a long time, in Idaho. And they did sheep. And so they sent us, they make sausage and whatever, all these things. And they used microchips on, like they worked with the Wildlife Service, I think it was Wildlife Refuge and Fish and Game, to track the main wolf. So whenever they were going, they would move their sheep according to where the wolves were, because they could track the wolf.
Yeah.
Oh, so there are things like that, that I think people are, that's that balance you're talking about that we can do, right? You know,
just. Yeah, I think for a lot of human history, coexistence meant like I'll live here and you'll live there, like kind of keep it separate. And there's really not here or there anymore. It's all, so we have the tools, like you're saying, there are many tools to coexist with wild animals, but it's about like do we want to, or are we willing to?
Mm. Yeah, it's like, I want a beautiful garden, but no snakes or spiders in it.
Right. That doesn't work. Exactly.
Doesn't work. Yeah. So what do you see happening now? Because I mean, they're endangered species, literally, right? You know, depending on where, what do you see happening in the future for wolves that we can do to help them? Are there organized, like the ranch that I was talking about, that they're trying? I mean, it's not perfect. I recall them saying, you know, we're not 100%, but they're trying to do it as a community too. And other people give them flack for it, but to do it as a community, like if people did that, I think would be cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's not one answer like we're saying, but I think that a good place to start is, and I think this applies to wolf issues, but really any issue, whether it's conservation or politics or cultural stuff. I think a lot of times we get sort of fact obsessed and we just throw facts at each other. Like we try to convince someone who disagrees with us just by telling them the facts. And obviously facts are important and kind of can build the basis of an argument or a way of thinking. But you also have to just understand, like, people don't make decisions based on facts. They make decisions based on their heart and how they grew up and the culture that they're part of. And so I think, to give some grace and to like listen and try to understand why people have the perspectives they do have, whether it's on wolves or cougars or politics, whatever it is, I think that's so important. And to recognize that it maybe isn't necessarily about the topic at hand. So a story that comes to mind for that is I went to the Cattle Producers of Washington's annual dinner, right? Like fundraising dinner.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very interesting. And a number of the speakers talked about wolves, what a bad thing they were for their operations. And then the keynote speaker, this guy named Bill Buehler, who is the executive director of KPAO, which is like a national advocacy organization for small ranches. He got up and he said, and he's like just total cowboy. He got up and he said like, hey, your problem isn't wolves, it's the economy. And his whole point was that like, it's gotten harder and harder to be a rancher because of trade deals and just economic forces and political decisions and sort of this sucking up of wealth out of rural areas into urban areas. And that all, his point is that all makes it just that much harder to be a rancher. And so then a wolf killing one or two cattle a year, which is really isn't that much, then it begins, that makes a difference at that point. And it's just like one more drop in the bucket. And so I think if you can understand some of that, it maybe gives a little empathy toward a group that maybe you totally disagree with. And then the tricky part is like not giving up your values and holding true to what you believe in, but while still listening. So that's the hard part. But I think that's a one thing I really hope people can kind of take away from this book and apply to any aspect of their lives.
Yeah, the polarization of things is insane.
Yeah, it doesn't get us anywhere.
No. Yeah. And I think that's really true, because we've done some things and that once you go down like the rabbit holes that you went down, the wolf hole, you went into the den.
Yeah, right.
But even when they say that too, you're going in the wolf's den, I'm like, oh cool, do you have babies? No. But for other people, that's like a negative thing. But But when you go into that and you're seeing all the different perspectives, it's like, you can find some balance there, but it's, I kind of go with that guy on all these different deals that are done. Like from when we did the wild horse thing, it was like the ranchers versus the wild horse lovers. And then, you know, it's like the, because they're fighting over the public land that the ranchers are paying at that time. And we were really involved in that was years ago, but we're still, you know, keeping our ear to the ground. The ranches were only paying like, I think maybe $4 a head of cattle to graze them on public land or something like that.
Yeah, it's fair. It's very cheap. I don't know exactly what it is now, but it's very cheap.
Yeah. So everybody was like, why are we doing this to our public land and all of that? So I think it's just kind of, it's deals that are done that maybe don't even involve the people that are now upset about, you know what I mean? It's
yeah,
like,
right. The, yeah. It's stuff that's happened years before. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like a, if we get together, that's an important thing, you know? Right. So, yeah. So communication.
Yeah. I think that's key. And then specifically, I mean, to the wolf stuff in specifics, I think there's a lot of like, so range riding, which is the main character of my book is a range rider, right? Okay. And he goes out on a horse or an ATV and tries to keep wolves away from cattle. That's like one of these tools. It's not the only tool, but it's one of these tools for coexistence with wolves. And there's actually an ongoing study right now in a number of Western states trying to figure out and sort of make it scalable coexistence strategies and see how effective they are and what sort of best practices are for it. Because up until now, it's been a bit hodgepodge, people figuring it out on the fly, and some of it works just incredibly well. But to try to standardize it to make it like a tool set that states and communities can pull from and have some trust that it will work.
What about the fact is once wolves go in there, the ecosystem starts to balance and get more prolific itself. So they start to actually eat what they normally would eat. Do you see that happening if we, you know, and then maybe they would kind of move away from the cattle? Is there anybody talk about that?
That definitely seems to happen a bit. I think that the impact of, so like the ecosystem balance, which wolves can kind of help, that is super noticeable in places like Yellowstone where there's not a lot of humans. It's a little more muted, from my understanding, in places like Washington. Yeah. Where it's just not as clear cut because there's just a lot more going on. There's more roads, there's more people, there's more you know, dogs and everything else. But all that to be said, the number of wolf attacks on cattle in Washington are fairly low. You know, it does happen, of course, and there's some research that indicates that for every attack that you find, there's a couple that you don't find, and that wolves just being around can decrease weight for the weight of the cattle and increase sort of miscarriages and this sort of thing, all of which impacts the ranchers. All that being said, it's a relatively low amount. So wolves are finding, they're eating other things, right? And they're very adaptable. Wolves on the coast will eat fish and wolves in Minnesota will eat beavers. And so they're super adaptable and omnivorous in that way.
Cool. I want to see. I haven't seen one in the wild. I've seen them.
It's really cool.
You know, I have not done that, but I understand what you mean about that eye contact of, you know, that just chill out, man. Yeah. But I think it'd be cool, like to just experience and just move on. Let them be.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's hard where I live. It's pretty mountainous and treed. Mm-hmm. And so I know people who've spent their whole lives trying to see wolves and haven't. So it's kind of, it can be difficult. It's not like in these broad open plains, maybe in like Yellowstone or something where you can get a spotting scope and really find them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What was it like writing a book after doing, articles and having to be so fast, that fast turnaround, and then suddenly now it's a book. And it's like, how was that process?
It was a whole mind shift. It was really fun and it's something I'd always wanted to do. But it definitely, that change, switching gears from daily work to long-term project, like a book length, it took a bit. And I had to sort of change how I thought, because a lot of the stuff, like the way I'd normally approach it, it would be irrelevant by the time the book came out. So Yeah, it was a cool process. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Well, it's a story too. That's what people should know as well. It's a story.
And that's what I tried to do. I mean, it's a nonfiction book, of course, and there's plenty of science and whatnot, but I really tried to make it a narrative experience and hopefully an easy and enjoyable read. So.
Yeah. I mean, I want to get out there on a horseback. I miss being on horses.
I spent quite a lot of time. Yeah. Learning how to ride horses and trying to do the range riding thing for my reporting. So
hard. Range riding is not easy.
It's hard work.
It's exhausting. People think, oh, you know, the horse does all the work. You're just sitting on the back of it.
Right.
It's exhausting.
It is. Yeah. Weird hours. Bad pay.
Yeah. But being out in the wilderness is really cool too. Isn't that why he took that role in his life, is that he can be out there, you know, and once you're out there, that's the thing. Then you never want to go back. Like, to me, that's the hardest thing. It's like, what? Like, just leave me out there.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I wonder, do you think the more people go out into the wilderness and have positive experiences? And so this is one thing I learned, like, people go glamping because they don't want to go camping, but maybe then after they go glamping, they'll go camping. You know what I mean? Do baby steps to be cozy. Do you think that the more people go outside and learn to respect the environment and actually learn about what they're seeing and all of that, and get that kind of bug under their skin? That sounds bad for anybody. Now that didn't work. That didn't help. Go out there, get bit.
I know what you meant.
Once you get swept into that, that it will help with the balance factor.
I think so, to a point. Yeah, I think people care about what they know about, right? And so if you've got some lived connection to a place, you'll want to preserve it to whatever extent you can. I think the difference is, you know, there's different ways of engaging with the natural environment. So if it's sort of passive, and this is what I felt in myself, right? And I love being outside. I do a lot of outdoor activities, a fair bit more than most people, but there was no like urgency to it. It wasn't like, it was just like in between going back to my house and sleeping in my bed or whatever, even if I was camping, you know, it's just a few days. Whereas some people, not many people, really live with the land, and they have to live with the seasons and the cycles of nature. And so I think that's hard to get just by recreating. I think you kind of have to work with your hands and work on the land to feel that more.
Yeah, I agree. And I like the point of being open to hearing others' interpretations.
Yeah, that's what Daniel Curry. That's what Daniel Curry, the character in this book, was so brilliant at, is listening and trying to find that common ground and make it work. So.
Yeah, it's learning things. Like when you're out on horseback, right? You're also watching things, and you have to be super aware. You know, like I'm saying, it's not just like being a passenger in a car. You are watching the rocks. You're watching snakes, or, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Being hyper vigilant, you know, and I think that's that balance. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
Are you excited?
Thank you
Has
so
it
much.
Been
oh,
fun
so,
doing all these
so
media
fun.
Tours and everything?
I love it. Yeah.
Are you going to do it again?
Another book? I'd love to. I don't know about what at this point, but I have some ideas I'm kicking around. But no, it's been so fun. The writing was challenging and enjoyable and rewarding, and then this whole part of talking about it with people is just a blast. So I really appreciate being on your show.
Talking about the wolves, I appreciate that you see all perspectives, because I think it's the only way we're going to move forward. I really do, for any kind of balance. And I hope we have more like animal corridors. I think they just backed that bill that came out, the wildlife corridor just came out. So that's exciting. So I've seen some. We're out in where are we right now? We're in Maryland, and I've seen some actual bridges like that are just all trees and stuff, which is cool. I'm like, that's cool.
Yeah. Awesome. No, there's ways to make it work. There's ways to coexist. It's just if we choose to or not. So
go hiking. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. That's what we'll
Thank
do.
You.
Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. Again, the book is called The Return of Wolves, An Iconic Predator's Struggle to Survive in the American West. Again, that is by Eli Frankovich. Frankovic, excuse me there. And also keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. We're here with the Nature Connection every fourth Friday, and way more than that, as you know, we're daily, and we always talk about parks, nature, public lands, animals, all that good stuff. And we want to thank Margot Carrera, our collaborator on this. Go to her website, carrerafineartgallery.com. Thanks so much, Eli. You take care.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it. Thanks.